Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:34 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is April 16th. And I thought we'd kick off with Bitcoin because it did have a bit of a wobble in here today, and it bounced from the $60,000 level, which really was, I think, comforting for the bulls because it's a logical area where we might anticipate the first area of support to come through. I should mention, of course, that this is Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, so perhaps it behooves us to think about Bitcoin in terms of the longer term. I do think that Peter Thiel has a point when he says that Bitcoin is a Chinese tool to try and undermine the integrity of the dollar as the global reserve currency. There is no getting around the fact that the vast majority of Bitcoin crypto mining occurs in China. So anyone who says that Bitcoin could disappear overnight would really have to rely on a global outage of an EMP pulse type of operation. But the reality is that China could really damage Bitcoin if they wanted to. And they don't have to turn off the lights. They could simply tax it into oblivion. They certainly know what everyone is doing, and they're in the process of introducing their own digital currency. So if we start to think about the longer term, and not simply thinking about what the price is going to do from one day to the next, and think perhaps more in terms of exactly what it is that the cryptocurrencies do, well, what they are effectively is a mode of transporting money across international boundaries without using banks. So more than anything, that's the founding principle of the cryptocurrency sector, in that it is completely outside of the existing financial sector. That's where the revolutionary fervor comes from, but obviously that can also be weaponized from the perspective of any government that wants to exist outside of the global financial system, and particularly for a government that wishes to circumvent the global financial system. So the digital yuan is likely to be a counterbalance to the SWIFT system, and that's a very real phenomenon. That's not in the far future, it's probably more like the near future. Just where Bitcoin resides within that ambition is rather indeterminate. The sector itself is primarily a vehicle for hedging against the devaluation of fiat currencies, and additionally as a way of giving or taking a view that we're still in a very benign liquidity environment. It's a lightning rod for speculative activity, and there's plenty of that. We're still in an environment where we see that the total assets of central banks are still trending higher, and the total assets chart moved to a new high in here this week. So that is certainly confirmatory evidence that we are still seeing a benign environment overall. I'm rather at a loss, however, to explain why the size of the Fed's balance sheet has not been rising at a faster clip. They've said that they're buying $120 billion worth of bonds every month, but it's not rising at that every month. So that's certainly something that is a bit of an outlier, or it's a paradox I'm not entirely sure how to explain. If we come back to the Bitcoin chart and look at it on a log scale chart, I think we get more information. There is absolutely no getting around the fact that the price paused around the 60,000 level, and it was a loss of momentum overall. And we also had a trend inconsistency in that the breakout in the middle of March failed. And that was the first failed breakout that we'd seen in quite a while. Arguably, there was a failed upside break at the beginning of December as well, and the price did come back into the underlying range and subsequently broke on the upside. So it's extremely important now that the $60,000 level hold. Anyone who's got a leveraged position in Bitcoin has probably been raising stops. The one thing that people do when breakouts fail is they get surprised. And if they're lucky enough that the price rebounds subsequently, well, then they become more diligent about their stops subsequently. So we can anticipate that there will be stops in Bitcoin around the $55,000 area because that is just about where the price rallied from in the middle part of this month, or just at the end of last week. Now, when we think about what's next, well, if the $60,000 level holds, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, and it will have completed what is effectively a 2-month process of consolidation. So that will be still a reasonably benign environment, and of course, we're still in a very liquid environment overall. Because Bitcoin is a lightning rod for speculation, then as it rises, it creates demand for catch-up plays. So Ethereum was well off its lows in here today and pausing around the $2,500 level. Now, it is a little overbought in the short term, but it has been a really rather impressive breakout, and nothing has really happened to question the potential for additional upside. And then we have, of course, Ripple, which was beginning to play catch up with Ethereum. Now, we've had quite a bit of volatility over the course of just the last 3 sessions, but it is holding the 1.4 dollar area, and it is rebounding from that level in here today. So there's been a little bit of profit taking at the end of what's been a momentous week because Coinbase was the heavily anticipated IPO, and it jumped right off the open, and since then it really hasn't gone anywhere. But I think the most comforting fact for crypto investors is that it hasn't collapsed either. Now, the big question, of course, for crypto investors is whether the new chairman of the SEC is going to permission ETFs. There are at least 6 companies have put in proposals to launch the first crypto ETF. A good part of the reason why prices have been rallying in such an abrupt fashion over the course of the last few months is because is in anticipation of a positive result there. Well, perhaps we do get an ETF. I personally think that we don't have the conditions in terms of consumer and retail investor protections to in fact permission one, but that is largely beside the point. There is a groundswell of support and much more institutional participation in the market today than we had in 2017 when a similar argument was being made. So perhaps it's more likely on this occasion. When it was knocked back in 2017, well, then we had a really quite acute pullback for a few weeks before prices regrouped and kept going higher. But the near-term catalysts certainly are coalescing around this speculation about a new ETF. I'm really thinking then where would be the next big source of additional liquidity to fuel a further advance. One thing we certainly know is that Bitcoin itself now has a market cap of more than $1 trillion. The rest of the cryptocurrency sector is rapidly approaching $1 trillion. So As an entire asset class, we have a market cap of almost 2 trillion, and this is now turning into a very significant source of liquidity. It's also a big portion of the market. What's also interesting this week is gold is starting to pick back up, and it was up another $11 in here today. Now, I think it's important to highlight that back in August, and we'd had significant consecutive weeks on the upside, and the price most definitely accelerated. Then nobody was willing to consider the potential that we were going to enter a medium-term correction. And at the present time, there are few people that are willing to consider that the lows are in fact in. And the consistency of this decline that we've had since August has been that there have been a preponderance of downward dynamics, and that was particularly true in August, November, and January, and indeed in towards the end of February as well. Every time it's come back to a big round number like 1900, it bounced by more than $100. 1800, it bounced by more than $100, and now we're at 1700, and it is bouncing, and it has not quite yet rallied by more than $100. On this occasion, a more than $100 rally would take it back into the region of the trend mean, which is currently around the 1860 area, and a sustained move above that level will be required to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment beyond the short term. I think it's quite likely we're going to rally back up to that level, but then it will be for the bulls to prove whether it can sustain a move up and out of that area. The two things that we've seen this week that would be supportive of the view that we're towards the end of this correction in gold is that Indian imports are rising again. We had a very significant decline in Indian imports in 2020, and now we're getting a pretty significant rebound. So that's an additional source of new demand coming back into this market. Then the next source of potential and I think important support is that the Chinese government has allowed for a much greater quota of imports into China. So we're looking at a significant tonnage starting to come in April. And that is also reflective of China's, I think, intention to diversify their government holdings and reserves. But also, it's reflective of this demand for gold as a hedge against the devaluation of fiat currencies and the potential for inflation. Then, of course, we have the continued question about when are we going to see a meaningful turnaround in the total holdings of gold at ETFs. So we've had certainly some pullback and over the course of the last few months, and not much evidence yet that it is over. So investors are not yet convinced that gold has in fact bottomed. I think it is, though, worth considering that the size of the pullback in gold holdings is considerably milder than we've seen on other occasions when we've had medium-term corrections. And then there is the additional point that gold holdings at ETFs continued to rise throughout the period of subpar performance for the gold price all the way through the period from about 2015 onwards. And this chart on Bloomberg is taking quite a long time to load, so I'm going to come out of that. Now, when we then think about what's going on in terms of the gold market, well, so far prices continue to hold around this $1,700 area, and there is evidence of support coming back in, so that's generally positive for the gold miners. And there's, of course, this correlation that's been evolving now for over the last 8 months and since the peak in August for gold prices. And it is that people are looking at the trend in tips yields. And as tips yields rise, there was this conclusion that that was reflective of the real yield. So if the real yield is starting to, or if negative real yields are now no longer as powerful a factor, then there's less need to own gold. Well, tips yields contracted again in here this week, and that has corresponded with additional interest in the gold price. And then we can also think about 10-year treasuries, because the treasury yield has been moving in a reasonably dynamic manner in here this week. So it has now broken its sequence of higher reaction lows, and it is looking likely that we're going to see at least a reversionary rally, and that could take us back to the region of the trend mean, which is around the 1% level. So this is, I think, one of the bigger developments, that there was this, I think, conclusion, or I think generally accepted conclusion, that bond yields were only going to go one way. We've certainly started to see that reversing in here this week. And now we are looking at the potential that we could get mean reversion. That's been the primary rationale, and I'm really at a bit of a loss why this Bloomberg window isn't updating. So I'm going to try a different window, and we'll see if that works better. But if bond yields do engage in a process of mean reversion, well, then that is something that is going to be beneficial for stock markets generally. There is a lot of positive economic news coming out, and what we're definitely seeing on this occasion is that it is the US economy has bailed out the rest of the world. We can go back, and I do apologize for the intermittency of my internet connection. I'm going to see if I can change the router that I'm pointing at, and perhaps that will sort out the issue. But one thing we can think about is if we go back and look at what happened in 2008, the Chinese were surprised, and that does appear to have fixed the problem, thankfully. They were surprised by the depth of the pullback and how exposed the economy was to the global, or the particularly the US economy. So they engaged in a massive amount of, just really a very profound amount of stimulus. And what that did was basically rescue the entire global economy. And then they spent the next few years trying to unwind the massive leverage that had built up in the system. Well, now we can think about what's happening in the USA, because they have just printed trillions of dollars and given it away. So one of the biggest things that we saw in here this week was that banks, they've done extremely well on their trading businesses, but demand for loans has been coming down. And part of the reason for that demand for, or their loan books have been contracting, and those loan books have been contracting because of lack of demand rather than lack of a willingness to lend. And then when we look at the bank shares, they've done very well as a result of rising yields and the growth of the economy overall. But the reason that the loan books are contracting is because the economy is awash in cash, and consumers are flush with cash, and private savings are close to record high levels. And retail sales came in this week, and they were way above where they were before the pandemic. So it's reasonable to conclude that the US economy is booming. And it's likely to continue to boom as long as this supply of liquidity persists. So banks are continuing to do well, and the S&P 500 is defying the short-term overbought condition and continues to push on to new high ground, and it's closing in now on the 4200 level. Every time it has accelerated away from the trend mean like this, we've been set up for a process of mean reversion, but we're still in a benign environment overall, and the sectors that had been pausing for the last few months are now stabilizing again. So the Russell 2000 has been firming within its range. The Nasdaq, which had been particularly weighed down by rising yields, has rebounded in emphatic fashion as yields have started to come back down again. So we're in a very similar situation in the USA today as to what the Chinese were in back in 2010 and 11 and 12, which was that they spurred massive domestic economic growth and it rescued the entire global economy. So China's growth came in today in double digits. It's their highest growth rate in years. And a good part of the reason for that is because of massive stimulus in the USA with huge demand for Chinese exports. So that's been a very significant factor in China's continued ability to grow. But one thing that's interesting is that the Chinese market has been lagging, and the A-share index was in positive territory today, and it is at least steadying in the region of the trend mean. And I was looking at my list of custom indices today, and I found an interesting one which I think is rather relevant. And when we think about what exactly is going on in terms of the markets, when we think about China and its weighting within Asia, then if we look at simply the market caps, and I do need to type in the ticker correctly, but if we look at China's market cap relative to Asia ex-China, then what we can clearly see is that the ex-China portion of the markets is trending upwards now. And it hasn't trended upwards for a really quite a long time. So China's stock market has been outperforming much of the rest of Asia since about 2015. And a good part of the reason for that is because of the dominance of companies like Tencent and Alibaba in the weightings of the MSCI emerging markets, although I think Alibaba is not actually in the emerging markets because it doesn't have a Chinese listing. Tencent is the biggest weighting in the MSCI emerging markets. But this has been a clear change over the course of the last 3 months. So China's growth is certainly doing better, but that isn't the only factor. This increase in geopolitical tensions isn't going away, and it's likely to further intensify. And what we saw in here just over the course of the last week, and it might help to explain why bond yields are contracting, and despite the fact that we have this benign environment overall in the stock markets, and it's because of geopolitical tensions where the Iranian nuclear facilities had a significant cyber attack. There was a bit of a face-off between the USA and the Philippines versus China in the South China Sea over the potential for another reef to be taken over by the Chinese Navy. Then there was this raising of tariffs against Russia, but also the promise of a summit between the USA and Russia. And more than anything, that promise of a summit should probably be viewed in terms of the fact that one of the primary reasons why détente was originally suggested, and one of the reasons why Kissinger went to China, was to try and encircle Russia. And I do wonder whether we're seeing a similar kind of condition on this occasion, where they're going to Russia in order to try and normalize relations in order to encircle China. I think it is it's probably a clear conclusion that it's very hard to fight a war on two fronts. And if you have Russia on your side, it's a lot easier to encircle and to diminish China's ambitions. But if China succeeds in bringing Russia on board, it'll be more difficult to blunt their ambitions. And I think these are some of the more relevant longer-term considerations, and it's a good reason too why bond yields should be a little bit weaker. But then, of course, we have to think about the longer term and the clear determination by central banks, because it's not like Bitcoin and gold are rallying for no reason. They clearly are paying some attention to the fact that central banks are absolutely intent on devaluing their currencies. And this is not a uniquely US phenomenon, although, because the USA is printing more money than anyone else on a sustained basis, well, they want to have a weaker currency more than anybody else. So the dollar index continues to pull back from the region of the trend mean, and this continues to look like a developing top formation, and I think a very good example of a type 3 top, because we have ranging and we have time and we have size. The dollar index stopped rising in 2015, and in the last 6 years, it has done a great deal of ranging. And the amplitude of the range has been extremely wide, going, and this is the Bloomberg Dollar Spot Index, it's going from 1100 to 1300. And there are lots of examples of failed breaks on the upside and the downside. And now it is encountering resistance again in the region of the trend mean. And the USA is printing money like it is going out of fashion. So it's logical to think that the dollar should decline from here. It was oversold, it's had the reversion to the mean, it's now encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. It's quite likely that we've seen the extent of the dollar's rebound. And there is the real prospect that we are now going to see an additional leg lower. I think the most important thing about the dollar is that it's extraordinarily cyclical, and it tends to move in 7-year trends. So we had a rebound from about 2011 up to about 2017, or arguably until the peak in 2020. When we go back and look at the way that this trends evolve, once it peaks, it tends to go downwards for a rather long time as well. I think we do have to go to the dollar index to get that back history. And when it does peak, it tends to fall for 7 years as well. So If the peak was in 2017, well, then we're likely to see a low in 2024. If the peak was in 2020, it might not bottom until 2027. So it really does depend on which peak we're likely to take. But the one conclusion that we can draw is that every time it's peaked, it has moved to a new low. So that suggests that the dollar index will not bottom until it has exceeded the lows put in 2008. And that would suggest that the dollar index is going to pull back well below the 70 level. So that's a significant decline. It's a more than 20% depreciation of the dollar index from current levels, not least. And then, of course, we're already well below the peaks that were put in a few years ago. And against that background, we have to start thinking about what will happen in terms of the purchasing power of the dollar and the asset price inflation that will result in. So, what are the assets that do best in an inflationary environment? Well, fixed assets, those that can't be simply printed into existence. So, that's a pretty sound rationale for why gold should do better. I continue to look at this purchasing power parity price of gold because it pulled back from the region of the peaks in August, and it just looks like a consolidation. This doesn't look like a reversal, and to me, it looks like a meaningful consolidation following an accelerated move, which I think was to be expected. So, if the dollar call is correct, it's rational to think that on a purchasing power parity basis, gold is going to break on the upside and significantly exceed the peaks put in 2011 and in 1979 and 1980. And that fits very clearly into the secular bull market hypothesis. Then we can think about what's happening in terms of the copper price, because copper prices are now above the $4 area and coming up towards the upper side of what's effectively a 15-year range. And these extraordinarily lengthy ranges in commodities generally give way to the biggest trends. And we know what the rationale is. The rationale is very clear that governments everywhere are doing whatever they can to return to economic growth. And the easiest way to do that is infrastructure development. But infrastructure development is expensive. And the last thing they want to do is raise payroll taxes. So they have to find a way of funding this infrastructure development. And the answer that they've come up with is reasonably simple. They're going to tax corporations. And they're doing that not by raising corporate taxes in a meaningful fashion, but instead introducing new taxes. And of course, the beauty of emissions trading is that it has a moral element. So they don't have to come out and say, oh, we're going to tax you because we need the money. No, they're going to say instead, we're taxing you because we're trying to save the planet, and you should be trying to save it too. So it's a wonderful kind of tax. It's exactly the same kind of vice tax that allows countries to tax cigarettes, tax alcohol, and tax gasoline. And this is a type of taxation that's likely to trend higher. And the price of emissions is going to trend higher because it is entirely politically motivated. Well, we're definitely starting to see this change going on. So now that governments have figured out what the funding mechanism is for this infrastructure build, they're pretty much committed to building the kind of infrastructure that will be morally and ethically and politically permissible. So It means that there's going to be a lot of investment in renewable energy. And we're starting to see that there's a lot more interest now in solar, and the solar sector has completed a base formation, and it is now steadying in the region of its trend mean. And if bond yields come back further, then that will be a green light for additional speculative interest in these kinds of sectors. They are wholly dependent on low interest rates. This, I think, is one of the biggest transitions we've seen in the business models of the renewable energy sector, because historically, and certainly during the big energy bull market, what the rationale for investing in the renewable energy sector was that it did well and it became competitive with high oil prices. So the higher oil prices went, then the renewable energy sector was a high beta play on oil. Well, oil prices are now still a fraction of where they were back in 2008, and still stabilizing around this $60 area. The biggest challenge for the oil price is that the biggest consumers of oil and the biggest producers of machines that rely on oil are increasingly going towards batteries. So Volkswagen is still pausing now in the region of the peak from back in 2014, and it's quite likely that it will be able to push on to new high ground, because in the automotive sector has reached the conclusion that if you can't beat them, join them. They have understood that there is absolutely no future for a business model that has to buy carbon credits, which their biggest emerging competitor produces, so that the entire carbon credit trading market is designed to promote their competitors. And the primary reason that Tesla has been able to survive and thrive as long as it has is because it really gets its biggest competitors to fund its expansion. That's the primary reason that they're building a factory in Germany. Now, the building of that factory is going slower than anticipated, but it has certainly aroused the German automotive sector to the fact that companies like GM and Ford have already had to fund the build-out of Tesla's factories. What they would much prefer would be that the oil companies have to fund the development of their factories, and that does appear to be what the plan is. So we're going to see a great deal more of infrastructure development and renewable energy building, because these projects, they're not reliant on oil prices any longer. They're much more attuned to carbon credit pricing because they get to sell them. At least the power plants will get to sell those carbon credits instead of having to buy them for coal producing plants. They get to sell them if they've got wind and solar. And then, of course, there is the additional point that if interest rates are low, then it makes the economics of renewable energy even more attractive. So what they are in fact now, instead of being dependent on oil prices, it's much more likely that these sectors will be much more heavily influenced by emissions pricing and interest rates. And they can act independently of the oil price, even though oil is still the dominant force within the energy sector. And that ability to perform independently of oil is a completely new phenomenon in this bull market. And it represents the primary headwind to a secular bull market hypothesis, because the only way we're going to see oil prices break higher and run in a secular bull market fashion, which means to break out to new all-time highs, which would be above $140, and subsequently multiply to get up to somewhere around $500. The only possible way that can happen is with massive supply destruction and a completely new source of demand. Well, that completely new source of demand might be in the materials sector, but it's not apparent quite yet. Instead, it's more likely we're going to see significant additional demand for copper. And the copper miners are still on recovery trajectories. So Southern Copper has now broken out already, and it is trading out to new all-time highs. When we look at Freeport-McMoRan, it has also rebounded pretty emphatically in here this week, and it's a copper and gold producer, so it is doing well on both fronts. And those copper gold producers benefit from the continued ability of gold to hold on and to improve, as well as the secular bull market in copper. Arguably, if gold can break on the upside, and we are going to see the dollar decline for a further iteration of this 7-year bear market, that we can argue that gold is also still in a secular bull market. What I found rather interesting in here today was that it's some of the coal companies are starting to firm up. This is a benighted sector, and it went through a profound bear market, but Peabody Energy is now finding support in the region of the trend mean and firming within its base formation. Arch Coal is firming from the region of the trend mean. Well, arguably, Arch Coal is doing better because of demand for metallurgical coal. All of these wind turbines stand on large pillars, and those pillars require a great deal of steel. And it's still pretty much impossible to develop steel without metallurgical coal. In fact, it would require a massive secular investment in infrastructure in order to develop new steel-making potential that does not rely on vast quantities of metallurgical coal as well. Of course, it's not all plain sailing for the coal sector, and the US coal sector is certainly doing better than the Australian one. Whitehaven Coal pulled back in a very dynamic manner on lower guidance in here this week. Now, when we think about the steel producers and or the steel sector, then the SLX ETF has now completed a base formation, and that base is 8 years long. Companies like Nucor have done really spectacularly well, and it is extremely overbought in the short term, whereas the largest steel producer in the world, ArcelorMittal, is still just on the cusp of approaching the upper side of its base formation. When we think about the potential over the longer term, we can see that the last time that steel prices were this depressed was back in the early 2000s, and it resulted in a really profound bull market. If we're moving back into an environment where global infrastructure development is a real trend, and I do believe that that is the most likely scenario, then it's quite likely that we're going to have a significant bull market in the resources sector. What I find also interesting is that if we look at the resources sector in Australia, it is firming from the highs put in at the beginning of 2020. The FTSE 350 mining sector is also completing a lengthy base formation and looks very like the copper price overall. So this looks like a sector that is going to thrive. And it's an underowned sector overall relative to the technology sector. There's absolutely no denying that technology continues to perform admirably, and the pace of the advance continues to accelerate, and it has now completed the most recent range, and the most recent range is relatively similar to the one underlying it, and it found support in the region of the trend mean, which is absolutely ideal. So this is still a consistent trend. It's a steep trend, but it is consistent, and it is being fueled by liquidity, and it is that liquidity fuel which has been the primary tailwind for the stock market over the course of the last decade. So we are still within this bull market. We're still in a surging economic environment where sales and investment are continuing to increase. This is also creating demand for catch-up plays, and that is particularly relevant for Japan and also for Europe. The Nikkei is continuing to pause around the 30,000 level, but it looks like it's a new bull market overall. When we look at the broader TOPIX index, it has now broken out to new recovery highs. So that was one of the missing ingredients, and it is now following through on the upside. The second section index, which is the smaller companies, broke out in 2016, and now it is consolidating. This looks like a first step above the base, and it is pausing in the region of the upper side there. As the dollar starts to come back down, there is evidence now that the yen has, or the dollar has encountered resistance in the region of its sequence of lower rally highs. Having got all the way up to 110, it's unlikely, or at least we haven't seen any evidence yet, that the Japanese are more interested in devaluing their currency than the US are, than the Americans are. So that suggests that we're going to see the yen strengthen back down towards the lower side of the range again. As the euro steadies up, because the ECB is more interested in talking the currency down than actually doing anything about it, then the euro stocks is pushing back up towards the upper side of what is a 21-year range, and there is the potential that it will now be able to sustain a move up and out of that range. The FTSE 100 had broken out ahead of the pandemic, and now it is rallying back up towards and exceeded this week the 7,000 level. So this also looks like an index that can push up and out. The sector that has done best in Europe over the course of the last 20 years are mid-caps, and that remains still the case. Even though large caps have been doing better, the mid-caps have broken out to new highs in the UK this week, and I think it is likely that we're going to continue to see the higher growth portion of the European markets continue to lead on the upside. That's as true for the UK as it is for Germany, and the MDAX has also been pushing up and out of its range and moved to another new all-time high in here this week. So the growth section of Europe is very much tied to the mid-caps. The entire Japanese market is highly levered to the global reflation. The Australian market is thriving both from the domestic technology, high growth sector, and the healthcare sector. And then also, and I do apologize that my internet connection is really extremely volatile today for whatever reason, but Looking at this longer term chart of the ASX, it's looking increasingly likely that it will push up and out of this range. When we look at Canada's market, we have a very similar condition where we've had a very I think impressive rebound since the low in 2020. We have a short-term overbought condition, but I think the next area of potential resistance that anyone is really looking at is that big psychological 20,000 level. When we think about the Swiss market, I think one of the smartest central bankers in the world are in Switzerland, where instead of pouring all of their printed cash into domestic bonds, they just bought the shares of the world's largest companies. And their rationale was simple enough that a cash flow is a cash flow, and aren't the cash flows of companies more reliable than the cash flows from governments? So perhaps it might just be better to buy the companies. And that has certainly been beneficial for the SMI market. It's been beneficial for the individual shares, but it's also been one of the differentiators in terms of the continued strength and of the Swiss franc. Well, as we look around the world, we're still in a reasonably benign environment, and we're still in a highly liquid environment, and there's no real sign of stress coming through in the funding markets. So banks remain in uptrends. High yield spreads are still at extraordinarily low levels. We've seen some easing in the yield curve spread, so that's also supportive of the, or at least it removes some risk that pressure is coming to bear. When we think about, well, what would be the factors that would contribute to a rolling over? Well, if we were to see problems arising in the credit markets and tightness arising in the credit markets, then that would be something to pay particular attention to. If geopolitical tensions start to really get out of hand, well, that could also be something that is worth paying attention to. That chart where we see the market cap of Asia appreciating relative to that of China suggests that we're already seeing a migration away from China, and there is the clear potential over the next decade it will gather pace because the hegemonic intentions of the Chinese administration are not simply going to evaporate overnight. We're likely to see clear intentions to grow out of the debt problems, and that's likely to create an inflationary bias. So we may yet be at the lower end of the range for gold and potentially at the end of this medium-term correction, but there's been enough of technical damage done that it will take a little bit of time to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. In the meantime, there's likely to be a great deal of investment, and the resources sector looks like it has a long way to go on the upside. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.